Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah. They have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. I'm the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist, but having said that, I want to be like me.
You don't know what you're talking about.
When did you know that?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'm going to leave it there.
I'd say it to your face, and I'll say it to you now.
I'm down to Anfield, and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
Well, it looks like there might be a bit of life left in the Champions League race after all, thanks in no small part to David De Gea's furious backpedalling at the London Stadium last night. David, at some point you have to stop going backwards, stand there, get ready to save... Oh, no. Welcome to Monday's Second Cabin's Football Podcast. Hey, guys.
Hey, Owen.
Hello, Owen. How are you?
United's defeat to West Ham, coupled with Newcastle losing to Arsenal, has thrown the door wide open for Liverpool. Maybe even Brighton. I'm looking at a graph here from Euro Club Index that gives Liverpool a 36% chance of qualifying.
36%.
And Brighton only a 3% chance. Now, I don't claim to have all the advanced analytical tools that Euro Club Index has at its disposal, but I do have access to the league table and the fixture list.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see that Brighton would go above Liverpool into fifth if they win all their games in hand, starting tonight at home to Everton. So, of course, at that point, they're only looking for some slip-ups. And, oh, they happen to be playing Newcastle themselves, so they could help Newcastle on their way to that slip-up. They do still have to play Arsenal and Man City in their run-in, so it's not the easiest run-in for Brighton. But, listen, you can spin the Newcastle match into a positive for Roberto Mazzurri's men. At least there's a bit of excitement around it, because I did fear that relegation was going to be the only thing we'd have to talk about for the last few weeks up until...
And now what's we have on? Man United and Liverpool in a fight to the death.
Kinda.
And also Newcastle.
And Brighton. And Evan Ferguson's Brighton.
Man United,
can we handle this much excitement? That's the question
Man
now.
Man United still 77% according to this graph.
Okay. That graph doesn't watch a whole lot of Man United games.
Yeah, but I think you need
the graph knows all over.
The fixture list is like Bournemouth, Priest over 75s, Cup winners, Fulham, Sunderland 2004-2005 to finish.
It's that easy, is it?
It's something like that.
Wolves, Bournemouth, Chelsea, Fulham.
Yeah. Oh, that's kind.
Yeah.
That's very kind. Wolves on Premier Sports next weekend. Would you watch that or do you want to... search for something else like you told me you were going to do on Friday?
No.
Did you enjoy watching? Was it Dave Jones? I don't even know who was presenting because I didn't.
Was it Jones, Redknapp and Micah? Was that the team?
McDevitt, Delaney and Cunningham.
Didn't do it.
Went unwatched this weekend. Just one little... Sky bat their eyelashes at 3 p.m. one Saturday in a season and off you go running.
Well, Big Sam bats his eyelashes. And, you know, he's going to take on Pep Guardiola. That did it for me. It actually, in this occasion, it wasn't... I didn't make my decision primarily on the presenting team, but on the...
The dream scenario would have been McDevitt, Delaney, Cunningham doing Allardyce, Guardiola.
We still talked a bit of Allardyce at the start, Murph, because, you know, equal opportunity.
Oh, what did they say about Allardyce? Because I missed this.
Oh, Damien played for Allardyce.
Oh, yeah.
Damien loves Allardyce.
At Palace.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was very amused by the opening press conference. In football terms,
I'm the greatest.
No one's better than me. Pep. Yeah. He's like that. That's obviously for the players. You know, it's to show I am Big Sam. I'm that I'm that persona that you think I am.
Yeah,
and I'm
like, you know, larger than life.
Yeah, exactly. That's kind of way to impress
a colorful character.
Football men, by the sense. He was similar. He went into Palace, according to Damien. It was just like, listen, this is the team for tomorrow. Any of you got a problem with it? Don't want to hear about it.
Yeah.
this kind of stuff.
I saw that. Certainly, if I was Aladicio, I could have managed Man United.
In your game, when they finally dropped Eric Dyer,
yeah,
the sacred cow got the shot, and they win the match. So I don't know.
There if you that's... go. If Liverpool do make it, they can thank Trent Alexander-Arnold's recent transformation to midfield maestro. Fullback come midfield maestro, a move that has put to bed any doubts about his ability to operate in a central role. Surely, one man remains to be convinced, though.
I think he's the best Premier League player in the last 10 years.
That's not Damien actually talking about about Trent. That's Damien talking about David Silva back in the day.
Silva,
yeah,
his passing is so good.
Yeah. Silva
keeps creating overloads all over the pitch.
Yeah.
What about
so patient?
Any of about 50 other players? We're not going to do this again. But
We've done the Silva one, right? But what we're this is the backstory here. I did the Liverpool Leeds game with Damien on Premier Sports recently, and he was scathing about the idea of Trent in a more central role. He subsequently caught wind of you, Ken, waxing lyrical about your own vindication on the matter.
A nation grows great when old men plant trees in the shade of which they will never sit.
Damien sent that clip to me.
Old man.
Damien sent that clip to me with a load of crying laughing emojis and the caption, "What the fuck is this bollocks?" So he's demanded an in-studio debate, and it's going to happen this Thursday. The great Trent centre mid debate, Ken Early versus Damien.
Who cares about the Champions League semi-final?
We'll talk about that as well. There'll be a bit of time.
You're ready for this, Ken? You're ready for Damien?
I suppose I have no choice.
It's true. It's happening now. That one is for World Service members only, as is our coverage of Real Madrid versus Man City. And the All-Italian clash in the other semi-final, as I keep calling it. That's all going to be available if you want to sign up now, or if you already are a member, of course. Today, we're talking about the recent report commissioned by the FAI into the funding of horse and greyhound racing in Ireland. This was first revealed by Daniel McDonald in the Irish Independent. The report found the state has given almost $1.5 billion to those two activities since 2001 through the Horse and Greyhound Fund. And given the betting tax was cut from 2% to 1% between 2006 and 2019, there was a shortfall to make up in that time. So €494 million, according to this report, was paid in from a separate part of the state's coffers to top up the funding. The FAI's argument in all this is that not all bets, you know, people bet on football too, quite a lot these days. A lot of the bets aren't placed on horse racing or greyhound racing for that matter. So therefore, there should be a fairer divvying up of the returns from the betting tax to other sports. Gavin Cooney has been writing about all this for the 42.ie. He's particularly interested in the government response to the initial report, even more than the report itself. So that's all coming up after your report on sport.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Well, and it's what a game. What a game that was at St. James's Park. These games really, every Newcastle game I see now turns into, Bloodsport is too much, but like there's just an edge to these games. You know, there's something, I mean, they get so angry. These games always get so angry. Whenever it's Newcastle against the kind of what are now their rival teams, their peer teams, such as formerly title chasing, still kind of title chasing Arsenal.
They're still chasing the title. I mean,
they are.
Yeah, they're like a long way behind. They can't really see the title anymore, but they're still chasing the title.
Yeah, and you never know what might happen. Maybe something unimaginable will happen.
Can't imagine that.
That's what we're.
Can't see it.
We have to look for. But this was a great performance from Arsenal in a number of different ways. I could see, for instance, George Culkin, who covers Newcastle, among other things, for The Athletic, tweeting, Newcastle, NUFC, not at their very best today, but there was a compliment in the way Arsenal played against them. Being good wasn't enough. They had to be spiky and smart, too. With Man U losing, it doesn't matter too much anyway. Well, we'll see about that. But in terms of the spiky and smart bit, what that refers to is gamesmanship and time wasting. Mm-hmm. We say spiky and smart in sort of the Newcastle world because this season it's unfashionable to refer to cheating and time wasting by those words. We use other words because Newcastle themselves have been the arch exponents of this in the Premier League, with the sole honourable exception of Brentford, who actually do it even a little bit more. Right, but Brentford aren't funded by
the Saudi
state.
Brentford.
They don't have Alexander Isak, you know what I mean? They don't have Bruno Guimaraes. They've got to try and make do. They do have even Ivan Toney, though, who is, I've got to say, pretty useful. It is a damn shame, you know, the whole situation with him. When is it going to be resolved? Hopefully that happens soon, because it does make it slightly awkward to buy him at the moment for anyone who's interested in doing it. But spiky and smart, right? So Arteta is like, we have to be spiky and smart. Now, I don't know how much of this was just revenge by Arsenal for what happened when Newcastle played at Arsenal earlier in the season, drew and just lay on the ground for most of the game, apart from when they were preparing to take a goal kick, which was like incredible. Like, I mean, you've seen rocket launches with less preparation than Eddie Pope. Not Eddie Pope.
Nick Pope.
Nick Pope's goal kicks. But Eddie Howe said after the game, wonderfully, it was frustrating because we wanted the ball in play. It was very stop-start, which suits the away team. So that is the coach of the team, which, according to Opta, takes the longest time to restart play after any stoppage of any Premier League team except Brentford, as we said. I think Brentford managed to play a game at Liverpool over the weekend which had 39 minutes of the ball in play, which was an impressive achievement. But Newcastle, I don't know if this was because Arteta was motivated by revenge or because he thought this was an effective way to win the game, or was it because he just knew that Newcastle United were going to get incredibly triggered and start completely losing their heads? You know, that could also be, maybe that was just something which happened.
An added bonus.
Serendipitous for Arsenal.
Hammer the hammer.
But that is what happened, to the point that Eddie Howe, the notable young coach, says that in his opinion, Newcastle United need to control their emotions. We could look with that. because I think with Newcastle, there's a couple of things I think about this. Number one, obviously, controlling your emotions, in the football sense, fine. What Newcastle really needs to do, obviously, is sort of channel the volcano energy of the stadium. You know, it suits Newcastle, I think, to play a kind of an emotional style, let's say. To a kind of a style of football. If I was saying, what should Newcastle do? I think they should obviously play something which is going to excite the fans, as opposed to kind of a, let's be clever. You know, let's be clever and contain and control and waste time. You know, I think they should lean into the
emotion. Although you're saying they do waste time, you were saying.
I mean, they do.
More than anyone else.
Yeah, they do. And I don't think they should. See, I think this is a terrible mistake by Eddie Howe. I think it's a long-term mistake, which by Howe, and obviously his, I can't mention Eddie Howe without mentioning Jason Tindall, you know? Jason Tindall, who, to watch a Newcastle game, you would assume was actually running the team. You know,
he was in first with the handshake.
Of course he is.
Again.
No, every time. I honestly think it's every time.
Until
you first pointed it out to me, that
Gary O'Neill snubbed him. Yeah. Gary O'Neill said, "Get away from me! I'm not shaking hands with you until I shake hands with my actual counterpart." But he's there. You know, he's shaking hands with everybody. You know, there's photographs of him shaking hands with Howe always kind of coming up behind him. It's a brains trust thing, you know. There's multiple brains linked in a network. You know, it doesn't matter that it's Tindall who, you know, in conventional terms, seems to present himself as the alpha of the duo, who seems to stride forward to accept the congratulations or commiserations of the opposing manager, not his opposite number, obviously.
Hmm.
This is a collegial thing. It's not about hierarchy. You know, it's not about I'm the man and you're my assistant.
Mm.
You know, even though technically Tindall is assistant. But sorry, where was I? I've distracted myself.
You were saying that they should
channel the emotion
time
of the
emotion.
Well, I think it's a long-term mistake for Newcastle to play the way that they have been doing with this time wasting gamesmanship, which they have been doing all season, right? Everybody, and that's why everybody was laughing at them yesterday, because it's a taste of their own medicine. And I think this is a mistake. It's a mistake for them to play a style which is going to get them the reputation of being an ugly team as well as an ugly project.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because they've obviously, you know, you could hear the plane. You hear the plane buzzing around. You're watching the game, you hear that.
I didn't notice it, Ken. I'm sorry.
I did notice it. The characteristic noise of a plane. It happens at most Premier League games now. This plane was saying free all Saudi prisoners. So obviously Newcastle have this ongoing issue, which of course, you know, the Newcastle fans are, we don't care about that or whatever. But to be a kind of a pig ugly team as well, you know, to playing this kind of gamesmanship style, don't do it. Like, why is he doing this? You know, it's just, you don't need to do it. You've actually got the resources to look at what Guardiola has done. Look at what Klopp has done. You don't need to play this way to be successful.
Well, he's leaning into the siege mentality thing. He's leaning into the no one likes us, we don't care. Why not embrace that? And that actually helps whip up the fans. I know fans love high tempo football and so on.
Mm.
But also, the Newcastle fans seem to enjoy what they see during all this time wasting, which is the shenanigans that the Newcastle players get up to, yeah. And it actually does whip them up, even if it's not very exciting football.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's not very exciting football either, by the way, Owen, because Newcastle are an exciting team to watch in many ways. Like they're an incredibly powerful team, right? Mm-hmm. They're so, like, in the first few minutes of the game yesterday, it looked like they were going to smash Arsenal, like as they have done to a few teams recently. Like they were just going to roll over the top of Arsenal. You know, Murphy hit the post. Then they had this penalty, which Howe blamed for kind of knocking them off their stride. Certainly knocked Alan Shearer off his stride. I don't know if you saw him ranting at Dermot Gallagher.
No.
Well, it was amazing. It was on like Premier League TV or something. And it was honestly, it was like a few good men, you know. Shearer, for some reason, thinks he's Tom Cruise. And Gallagher was there as the sort of the patsy who's been dragged to justify this refereeing outrage. And Shearer is screaming at him, think, Dermot, you know, how can you be sure that didn't hit his hand? While, with perfect timing, the footage, the angle plays, showing the ball clearly hitting Kivior's leg, not his arm, which is behind his leg. He's actually whipped it down to behind, you know, so he can't. And just amazing stuff. Like, this is a guy who, as about a billion people pointed out in the tweets underneath it, was last week demanding Jurgen Klopp be, you know, whatever, touchline ban for a similar performance for the team he actually manages, you know what I mean? In the like, he's actually standing there at the sideline at the game, loses his head. But okay, so it knocked Newcastle out of their stride. What I'm saying is, there are exciting things about the team. Isak in particular is absolutely incredible, right? The others, like, they've got a couple of great Brazilian players. They just sort of exude this power, and I just don't think there's any need for the other stuff that they go on with. And I think that's going to be long term. It's going to be a real problem for Eddie Howe unless he fixes it. And
why though? Why is it going to be a problem?
Because everyone will dislike them, and actually, some of the fans will start to complain about it as well.
Fans won't complain as long as they're being successful.
As long as they're being successful.
Well, that's going to be the case regardless.
Yeah, but I also disagree that this is the best way to be successful. I mean, if I look at that graph, you know, average time before restarting play. The team that's in most of a hurry to get the game going again is Liverpool. The second most hurrying team that wants to play the game is Manchester City. The third is Leicester City, also, who won the Premier League recently. Although they might have been a bit slower about it, to be fair, when they were winning that Premier League.
Yeah.
Spurs, Manchester United, Chelsea. So we're looking at the sort of top teams. Arsenal.
Top teams?
Well, you know, I mean,
Big club mentality, Tom.
There's Brighton there as well. Arsenal are also just inside the top half. And when you look down the bottom, I see Everton, Southampton, Bournemouth, Newcastle, Brentford. You know,
That's mainly because they're behind in most, in a lot of games.
They're just not very good teams, so they have to do it like that.
Yeah, I don't think Newcastle have to do it like that. I think it's a silly affectation from Eddie Howe. I don't know if he's trying to be some kind of a tough guy, like he's trying to be a hard man like Diego Simeone. Like Eddie Howe wants to walk into the bar from Dusk Till Dawn, and everyone will be like, oh, here's Eddie, you know, sort of, there'll be a hush. He'll come in. Obviously, Tindall will
I was going to say, it's Tindall first.
Yeah, Tindall.
Here's Tindall, and behind him, here's Eddie.
You know, hand his coat to the
doors is of the saloon, whacking Eddie Howe in the face as Tindall walks through the. sorry.
Yeah, but you know,
I'm here too.
This is silly. He's creating a rod for his own back, in my opinion. Anyway, in this instance, it was the biter bit. Arsenal were doing a bit of flopping and complaining about injuries and so on and so forth. But still, it was Newcastle who got triggered by not being given a phantom penalty that the referee wanted to give them. They booed the ref off, even though he did everything he could to try and give them that penalty. And then it was taken away. Then there was this amazing goal by Odegaard. Now, I will say that I don't think it was Popey's best moment, because when you are beaten by a shot from nearly 30 yards that actually goes kind of a yard inside the post, probably you need to get closer to that shot. I mean, if you look at him, his dive is very late and he doesn't get much distance on it at all. But he's obviously surprised by the shot. And Odegaard, in absolutely was incredible in the first half of that game. Is he kind of the new De Bruyne at this point? I mean, is he kind of the player who's best positioned to be that sort of figure in the league over the coming seasons? I mean, I think he probably is, right?
Potentially, yeah.
Well, he scored obviously his goal, which you know, the record that ever, the non-penalty goals record. He has the most non-penalty goals for midfielder, along with De Bruyne, scored in the season. And he's obviously got a couple of games left to break the record. I mean, he's obviously a different player from De Bruyne. I don't think he's quite as powerful. I don't think he's got quite the kind of running dynamism that De Bruyne has had. But he's got incredible vision of the game. So kind of elegant in his style. And has done some things this season which are just ridiculous. You know, little bits of improvisation, like things, little manipulations of the ball that you can't remember seeing anyone do before. You know what I mean? Which he seems to kind of just create in the moment. An absolutely phenomenal player. I mean, I was thinking actually watching, I was like, it's quite difficult to pick a team of the season this year. Like, if you're going to pick a team of the season, I think there are only two players who walk into it who everybody would have in their team, and I can test that by asking you.
Well, Erling Haaland, you're going to say Odegaard. I would Saka.
I wouldn't say Saka would be a universal choice in the matter of this other player.
Oh, hang on, you've already done two. I've already done two. Haaland and
Haaland. I agree is a definite, obviously.
Mm. And Odegaard, is that not the two? Did you ask for two?
No, I'm not talking about. I think Odegaard is debatable because there's lots of good players. I mean, I think I would have Odegaard, but
well, the easiest way to pick a goalkeeper is to check which goalkeepers had the most clean sheets. So could you just check that stat there? So the goalkeeper with the most clean sheets obviously is the best goalie in the Premier League. So that's
He is
David De Gea, Manchester United.
De Gea I would put Alisson as the goalkeeper. I think he's the best goalkeeper. And I think he's had a good season. Mm. But when I'm looking through the rest of the team, I mean...
Midfield, Trent Alexander-Arnold.
Well, I don't think he's had a good enough season to be getting into any teams of the season. Mm. But Saka, I would say... I mean, you would obviously have to pick the 3-2-4-1 because it's like the formation of the season. Everyone's doing it, you know?
Okay.
Everyone's playing 3-2-4-1 now. Or at least, you know, all the best people.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I think you've got to pick, obviously, Kevin De Bruyne.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to say you've got to pick Odegaard. And then I think you've got to pick Bukayo Saka.
Yeah.
And then...
Martinelli's got more goals than him, hasn't he?
Yeah, see, I also want to pick Martinelli there, but are we in danger of not picking Arsenal. Enough Man City players? It's just all Arsenal.
Well, also, what about Isak?
Haaland, De Bruyne.
I honestly would pick Alexander Isak in the team as the left-sided forward.
No, hold on.
Over the course of the second half of the season, but he did miss half the season.
Well, he missed. It wasn't his fault that he was injured. When you look at what he's done when he's played, it's not like he was terrible for did nothing for half the season and then suddenly he's on fire for the second half. It's like he missed.
No, but it's the contribution over a season. It's not his fault that he was injured. It's recency bias. You just had that dribble against, was it Everton, that ridiculous dribble along this.
In fairness, it is one of the most amazing pieces of play I've ever seen. Yeah.
And it's
in
also
my life.
The fact that he's been overlooked for Callum Wilson.
Like, is Jack Grealish getting in this team, by the way? I mean, there's a lot. There's some.
Well, Grealish, Rashford. You know, these are like left-sided options. I mean, if you look at the center of midfield, Rodri, I mean, you kind of have to pick Rodri, right? I mean, like, there's a reason why Man City are unbeatable, you know, apparently unbeatable. Then you've got, like, Casemiro was very good for a while, but, like, has he been good enough for long enough?
He's missed a lot of football, self-evicted.
Bruno Guimarães, I mean, there's a reason why Newcastle are third in the league. Gundogan, like, it's just gave a performance against Leeds, which was like perfect, and then walked off and practically crying. I can't believe I missed this penalty. Oh, I feel so bad. You're like, so he broke the record for his own record for most passes in a game by a Premier League player, scored two goals and was like, oh, I'm so disappointed. I mean, this guy's ridiculous. I don't know. And you obviously wanted to throw Trent Alexander-Arnold in there.
Well, I'll save that up for Thursday.
And then in terms of the defense, Diaz, you know, Stones, Saliba was good for
Saliba, yeah.
His injury has been bad.
You've seen how much they missed him and he hasn't been there. So
sometimes missing a bit of a season actually plays into your hands.
Completely,
and this is
exactly
what's happened with Saliba.
Those Newcastle guys, Boltman and Scherer, have both been very good. Martinez has been very important. I mean, we can talk about Martinez, actually.
Can I just give you a little story first about our friend Odegaard, because he did a Players Tribune article a while ago. Don't know if you read that.
Odegaard.
Yeah.
Go on.
He had you were just talking about his ability to, I don't know how you quite phrased it, but anyway, I'll talk about what he said. He was particularly, his dad is, he had this pushy, well, he doesn't say pushy dad. He said, you might call him a pushy dad, but he's just a dad who made me train relentlessly all morning and all night. He was particularly obsessed with me developing my awareness and quick feet. He was always getting me to look over my shoulder before receiving the ball. In winter, when we couldn't play outside, he took me to the indoor sports hall. We would do drills where he'd play the ball off bench and would bounce back to me. He'd come up behind, pressing me from one side, and I had to look and adjust before receiving it. These days, when you see me turn away from a defender, using that touch and quick reading of the game, that's the sports hall. That's my dad.
That's the sports hall.
So that's what you're talking about.
That's the sports hall. That's my dad, he said in the cadence of the great American sports hall. he did one touch in the game yesterday where there was kind of, Arsenal were sort of playing the ball cross field and there was a kind of a weird ball coming at him from a strange height, and a Newcastle player running up to smash him from behind.
It's literally the sports hall and his dad. But go on.
Well, it's like his dad was being played by whoever it was, big Dan Byrne or whoever. And what he did was just, I think he sort of took a little touch to control it, but then it was an instant, like, outside of the foot, round the corner pass. Like, it looked like he was going to have to take another touch to properly control the ball, but instead he just passed it with the outside of his foot into the path of a teammate, which was just brilliant. And he's been doing these kinds of things.
Yeah.
So I suppose Martin Odegaard, good player.
He's in there. He's in your team of the year. Martinez, you want to talk about Man United?
There's Caicedo, McAllister, these kinds of guys as well to consider. But yeah, and as we say, Manchester United, we'll get to that. We'll get back to that team of the year stuff. I was just thinking, it is unusually difficult. Like, there's a lot of, anyway, Manchester United, David De Gea. Yeah. So David De Gea is now in the Hugo Lloris zone, by which I mean the four errors leading to opposition goals this season in the league zone, which isn't a good zone. They're the only players in the zone. Another stat from up to us, they've lost 8 away games this season, which equals their worst ever Premier League seasons, which were, in terms of away defeats, which were 21-22, not so long ago, and 2015-16. So both in the post-Fergie era, or all three, rather. They never were this bad under Ferguson. And they've done it 3 times in, like, the last 7 seasons. Ferguson, 10 years ago today that they announced his, or he announced his resignation. But yeah,
I was sitting in a cafe in Temple Bar again.
Oh, you remember where you were?
Weirdly, wow. Just when you said it, I do.
What was your reaction on?
Wow.
Wow, the big man.
Better.
What a career.
Slurp down this coffee and get into work.
Don't be sad that it's over.
Yeah.
Be happy that it happened.
Something like that, yeah.
Well, there was this feeling at West Ham of things are sliding badly out of control here for Manchester United. And while they still have it, as Erik ten Hag said, in their own hands, and the fixture list is kind, the form is cruel. And it seems maybe looking at what's happened over the last few games that we can draw the conclusion that the most important signing was the one that was criticised the most at the time. Martinez, who injured himself against Sevilla, I remember the last minutes of that game. Since then, they played 7 games and won 2. And it's like the whole thing has collapsed. It turns out that he was actually making the whole thing work.
Well, Varane as well.
Varane,
The loss of both of them, it might be a compound issue.
It's a cascade, you know. And when Martinez is not there, suddenly they can't really pass the ball out anymore. And it also makes De Gea's job more difficult. Now, this isn't relevant to the specific goal that they scored, which is just a mistake by De Gea that's like, well, come on. Yeah. But it's
not many
more
times I'd say Simon Hick would have saved that.
But he honestly, absolutely that one, wouldn't. He, by the way,
no, he's the worst keeper I've ever seen in any sport by a mile. But I still think Simon might have got there.
Yeah, well, definitely David De Gea should have got there. I mean, he saw the reaction of everybody—just surprise from West Ham and kind of, you know, no one making eye contact from the Manchester United side, but also. If I'm talking about Martinez, it makes his job more, De Gea's job more difficult because he can't pass the ball. And at least with Martinez there, he had someone he could pass to who he could be pretty sure under pressure would be able to deal with it and do something semi-useful with the situation. Whereas now, it's really so easy to press them. Every time De Gea has the ball, it's just all you're trying to do is get him to shank a long kick into the middle, which Manchester United will not win. Who's he going to kick to? Anthony? You know what I mean? Is he going to kick it to Weghorst? Maybe. I mean, in theory, yes, but in practice, it doesn't work. You know, Anthony obviously has been pretty disappointing. This is one that obviously Ten Hag himself pushed for. You know, there was in the ongoing Carragher Neville thing. I do wonder if it's going to lead to a big falling out at some point because, you know, just the opinion's getting more trenchant. But Neville had complaining about the Glazers again. Yeah, the Glazers decide to play Weghorst as a 10, spend 90 million on Anthony and 70 million on Casemiro, 31, on a 5-year deal, was the criticism. So this is now a difficult situation for Ten Hag. I thought it was interesting that his approach after the game was not, remember earlier in the season we were talking about United who were often winning and Ten Hag complaining. And criticising the performances and saying this wasn't good. It wasn't just after they won, it was also sometimes after they lost. He stopped doing that. Now he's kind of like, you know, my boys, my sweet boys, let's get together to the end of the season, it's all in our hands. You know,
I thought that he was very muted yesterday, and Moyes was quite muted in victory. It was a disappointing post-match interviews.
Yeah, Moyes. And because if United had managed to equalise, imagine what would have happened in terms of Moyes and the disrespect shown by VAR to him. Remember that it was Thiago against West Ham getting away with that multiple handball, was it only last weekend? And this time it's Lindelof. I mean, how can you not give that as a handball? He punched the ball into his own face. Yeah. Like, come on, you know, that's like a... Definitely he moves his hand into the ball. But wasn't given, luckily enough, for West Ham. It didn't matter. They got the win.
So why, just on Ten Hag, why do you think he's changed his tack?
Because he can't keep hammering them. You know, it's like things are actually bad now in a way they weren't. When he was complaining about details earlier in the season, he's like, you know, we need to do better. But now it's like, this is looking a bit ropey. You know, there's serious pressure now. It's like, we only need to win 3 out of 4. It's like, that sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
You've won 2 of the last 7. You know? Like,
2 of the last 4 is a major, major improvement on your current form.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's if the other teams, you know, Brighton and Liverpool, keep winning.
Yeah.
But at the moment, it looks as though they can do that. So Where are we? Oh, well, we should get back to the City Big Sam game, because that was, as we know, the main event on Saturday. And I, for one, was a keen viewer of this.
All right. Jesus. I thought we'd covered this.
But you see, what City did in the game was quite simple, but it worked really well. They were like, okay, Sam Allardyce is going to tell all his players to camp in front of their goal and park the bus. That means that basically all the room from like the edge of the box out will be ours. So why don't we just go there and then kick the ball into the goal? Let's see if that works. And it did. And so this is what they kept doing. Every time Mahrez was in position, not quite every time, there was one time he actually spun across towards Haaland. But usually what he did, when they kept giving the ball to Mahrez on the right, and then he would, and then they'd have a couple of players, usually Haaland, maybe someone else, kind of running towards the six-yard box. And all of the Leeds players, all the nine Leeds players, are concerned with defending that area, and then they would just roll the ball in front of those backtracking Leeds players to someone who's coming in. And so this happened like minute 12, minute 16, minute 16 again, minute 19, then that was the goal. Then it happened, I think, minute 23. You know, it's the same thing every time. You know, if you saw the Leeds after the first goal, which couldn't against score both, Sam and Carl Robinson, his assistant, are like, whoa, you know, talking, what are we going to do? But they didn't change anything, it looked like, because City kept doing the same thing, and then they scored the same goal again. Is it the same two players, same method? You want to defend, you want to just get back there, then that's fine, we'll just...
It is that thing that City do ruthlessly exploit. If it's just one single weakness, we'll just keep doing the same thing until you put something there to stop it.
And you're not going to do anything. You know, if to watch City move the ball up the field, it was interesting. All they had to do was walk with the ball. And Leeds weren't trying to get it off them. You know, so Leeds only were trying to actually challenge City kind of more or less in their half of their own half. You know what I mean? Mm. City, there was no sort of pressure being put on them higher up the field. Players walking along, literally walking, strolling with the ball, and then just passing the ball sideways, strolling a bit further until we're now camped around Leeds' box. This is the game they want to play. This is a really easy game for us. But I think that the actual patience to do what City do, like the kind of calmness to say, okay, they're sort of retreating, but we don't need to hurry here. Mm. We're just going to walk up the field, get in the position we want, and then see what we can do. A lot of teams can't actually do that. So I think that what Sam Allardyce was doing would work against a lot of teams. You know, it would be like, oh, it's 70 minutes, we still haven't scored. Oh, people are losing their heads. It could even potentially work against City if you got really, really lucky. Because Leeds did get lucky to only lose this game 2-1. Haaland had six shots and didn't score. And that has only happened once before this season where he had that many shots and didn't score a goal. So obviously he gave the penalty to Gundogan to have a hat trick, which I thought was actually incredible that he did that. I mean, I think it was good, but Guardiola was really annoyed.
Oh, straight away.
He was angry because it's like, well, you know, this is bullshit, score the goal, you know, we can't be...
We know you're a nice guy, Erling, you don't have to show the chair. I was quite struck by Gundogan's reaction to it. He was so chuffed. What a mark of respect, big man. Thanks so much.
Well, seriously, this guy's chasing records all over the place, but he obviously doesn't care about them that much. Not yet.
I mean, it was a fairly easy argument for him to make to Gundogan to say, well, listen, it's only 2-0.
You know,
we've got
trick,
a
mate.
Treble to win here, you know?
Yeah. You know, come on. We've got a treble to win, and I'm also chasing Dixie Dean.
You know, Ilke, I know you're looking for a hat-trick, but we're looking for a hat-trick as a team as well. A hat-trick of titles.
There's no hat-trick
for that
in
reason, Ilke, I'm sorry. I must take this penalty. I mean, I'm really sorry.
I think, in fairness,
I'm really sorry.
Gundogan didn't even want to really take the ball. He was kind of like, are you sure? You know, and Haaland's like, oh, go on, mate. You know.
I'm with my friend Murph on this one. I think Haaland and my pal Pep. I think penalty taker takes the penalty. Shearer said even if it's 7-0, the penalty taker takes the penalty.
Well, Shearer obviously wouldn't hand it over the penalty. But I thought it was an interesting thing for Haaland to do. A player in that position who has already set a record. Every goal he sets is extending it. And he is closing in. I mentioned the Dixie Dean, like 12 goals to equal Dixie Dean's like all-time, all-competition record. He obviously doesn't care about that at all. I mean, I realized over the weekend I didn't really know that much about Dixie Dean when I read a piece about him by Paul McParlin on the Guardian. which contained the following fact, which I had never heard before, which I actually find surprising, you can tell me if you also find it surprising when you hear the fact. Okay. Have you heard it before?
You'd better tell us.
Dean signed for his first club, Tranmere, in the summer of 1923. He made his full league debut against Rotherham, but Tranmere lost 5-1. He was sitting back at the stiffs. It was here the following month that his league ran. Then he had it, even before it had started. No. In February 1924. No. Sorry. Dean played
against... Hold on a second. Are you going to tell us that he played for Sligo Rovers?
No.
Okay, because I didn't know that one.
Dean played against Altrincham in the Cheshire Senior Cup. He scored 2 goals before his tormented marker warned him he would not score anymore, delivering a carefully aimed kick between Dean's legs. The pain was excruciating. He lost a testicle and his career was placed in jeopardy.
Wow.
Fucking hell.
Did not know that.
Jesus, that's...
No, I didn't know this at all. So Dixie Dean was doing all this, having lost a testicle.
Big Sam had actually said the same thing to Ilkay Gundogan at the weekend. That's why he missed the penalty.
The story goes on. Well, I never knew that Dixie Dean lost a testicle to a guy who was pissed off that he'd scored 2 goals.
Yeah.
Just 2 goals on him and didn't want to score. I mean, that's, you know, we...
You can't
about
be doing that, Ken. You can't be doing that.
I think it's bad. Years later, Dean was in a bar in Chester when someone offered to buy him a drink. Dean recognized the man as Davy Parks, who he believed was responsible for the loss of his testicle. As Dean told the story, he then laid his former opponent out with one punch. Revenge was sweet. Or was it? Meticulous research by biographers revealed Dean had assaulted the wrong man. So, I don't know. I guess it didn't. Justice was never served.
What a beautiful story.
Do you want to know?
Daisy chain of misery.
Do you want to know what you missed in the Spurs game?
Go on.
Harry Kane scored and Spurs won 1-0.
Harry Kane, 100 at home, 100 away.
209. Goal number 209 takes him above Wayne Rooney to second place.
What
solo.
What an even split that is as well. 100 and 109. Mm. I mean, that's a mark of something, isn't it?
Something. It's something, all right.
What's happening is, I thought the end of the City Leeds game was interesting because of the way that, for the first time in about 3 months, City suddenly felt a jolt of, oh no, you know, are we about to... Did you see Pep pumping the water into himself?
Yeah.
He was like the, you know, eyes like darting around and he's just like funneling water into his belly. And I thought, you know, and the way Gundogan was kind of so disappointed after literally like one of the greatest midfield performances of all time, you know, like one of the most dominant in certain ways to them, you know. Is that what you want to be feeling as you prepare to play against Real Madrid? Because, look, I mean, it's no surprise to you that I don't give Real Madrid much of a chance of getting past Manchester City. You know, I don't think that they will. I think that Manchester City are going to do it this time. I think they're going to do them this time, Owen. I just feel as though they've gone to the next level, and I don't see that Real Madrid really are able to match that level. I mean, if you see City's last 16 matches, 15 wins in the last 16.
Don't bother talking to me about Real Madrid in La Liga. They don't care. They happen to pick up a La Liga title every 5 or 6 years, keeps them ticking over. But they're a Champions League team, and I've been impressed with them in the Champions League.
Well, you know, all I'm saying, Owen, is that there might be a little bit too much "we are Real Madrid" going on here, and not enough "what are we actually going to do about Haaland and everything else Man City do?" The last 16 Man City games, 15 wins out of 16. So the only exception there is their 1-1 draw against Bayern, which was in Munich, and they only didn't win on the night because they had a penalty given against them in the last minute, which was a bit harsh. And that was away in a game they were already leading 3-0. 52 goals scored and 8 conceded in those 16 matches. I mean, like, it's crazy. If you compare that to Man United's treble team, so this is the only other team that's achieved what City are trying to achieve, the equivalent the equivalent numbers for them, if you go back to this date and look at their last 16 matches that they played, 9 wins and 7 draws in 16. Yeah. 27 scored, 13 conceded. So City have scored like nearly twice as many in, you know, if you remember that treble season, that Manchester United team honestly seemed to have magical powers.
It was with the late goal thing. There were a lot of late goals that made it feel as though they had those magical powers.
It was just this incredible kind of epic. How long can they keep doing this? This is unbelievable. I can't believe what I'm seeing here. This city thing, it's almost, it's like watching a robotic lawnmower. You know, it's like, it's like a robot lawnmower going around cutting the grass. And, you know, it's like, this is great. You know, it takes a lot of work out of it. But it doesn't have that sense of, oh my God, I can't believe what I'm seeing here, you know?
I'm using my own lawnmower.
but you know,
the, I know, man, I still get a rush every second Saturday.
When?
Get the lawnmower out.
Yeah. Cut your grass every 2 weeks?
Ah, yeah, probably.
In the summer, yeah. In the growing season, yeah. But you know,
stay on top of it on.
I think the it did mean that Man United were kind of, I mean, if you look at the treble season, the last 8 matches in the league are 4 wins and 4 draws. Can you imagine like the bottling discourse that would happen today if you produce 4 draws in your last 8 matches? But this was like the team with the greatest sort of mentality of all time. I think that they were kind of used to experiencing these difficult moments. I mean, every game was like, oh my God, what are we going to do now? You know, the City just aren't used to that. Like, no one's laid a glove on them in months. And this is the only reason that I have to doubt them against Real Madrid, because Real Madrid will not be afraid of them. Mm. You know, this is, maybe their confidence is completely unwarranted, you know, maybe, but at the same time, it exists.
I think he's talking himself around, though.
I know. He's talking sense at last.
Yeah, finally.
I don't think. Real Madrid's last 16, 110, drawn 1, lost 5. Lost 5 of the last 16, 4-33.
And they'll lose one of these legs as well, I can tell you that.
Nobody talk! Sit down! Drink wine and relax!
So look, that, drink wine, drink water.
Drink water.
So that's tomorrow. I'm looking forward to that. What else? Just Chelsea are going to sign Poch. So that's hardly news. And, well, this hasn't been confirmed. We'll see. Liverpool linked with Jörg Schmadtke as the new sporting director. There's been this talk at Liverpool, of course, of Jurgen Klopp having amassed too much power, in contrast to the, you know, the system they had in place before with people like Michael Edwards and Ian Graham and so on. So maybe they're going to address that by bringing in a 59-year-old German with what appears to be an encyclopedic knowledge of the Bundesliga 2005 to 2013. Schmadtke was, I think, last the sporting director at Wolfsburg, where I read in Raphael Honigstein's piece about him, he sold Victor Osimhen for €3.5 million to Charleroi, who promptly sold Victor Osimhen a couple of weeks later for €22 million.
Oh, wow.
Victor Osimhen has been involved in some strange transfers,
right?
You know, and this was before the Lille-Napoli transfer. But €3.5 million, he sold Osimhen.
That's a hell of a couple of weeks of training he's put down there, to be fair.
Yeah. But, you know, apparently, according to Archie Rintut, who you'll see on BT doing the Bundesliga, they know each other not through football, as you might expect, but through their mutual friends, Die Totenhosen. They're both friends with the German rockers.
Okay.
So, Jörg Schmadtke and Jürgen
Klopp. They're the ones who did the Timo Werner song, aren't
they? Owen, to be honest, I can't tell you.
No, Die Totenhosen are
massive superstars. Die Totenhosen are major band. Though.
Emo Werner song, Owen. I'll correct you there. You called it the Timo Werner song. That's incorrect.
Mm. So we'll see.
Just said it so Sonic can maybe play out with it later on.
The Schmad lad. He could be coming in to sort of admit.
Schmadzer.
I'm not, his quote, according to, I'm not as big an ass as people say.
People call them rats because a rat will do anything to survive. Isn't that right, Mr. Hill?
Objection.
I would not give Real Madrid a rat's chance against Chelsea.
You didn't give them a rat's chance.
If they get through against Chelsea, Owen, I do not give them a rat's chance.
Okay, there's rat's chance. Yeah. No rat's chance.
Camavinga searching for Benzema, who hooks it in. The goal back.
That's it.
Still,
come on. I will not give Real Madrid a rat's
against
chance.
City.
Not a rat's chance. It's going to catch up with you eventually. I don't believe in magic. I believe in reality. I believe in material reality.
Here comes Benzema. Side puts the ball in.
I don't know nothing about being a rat.
Mr. Hill, you know everything about being a rat.
I thought they would lose to PSG, they'd beat PSG. I thought they would lose to Chelsea, they'd beat Chelsea. I thought they would lose to Manchester City. And really, they should have lost to Manchester City.
And what about Liverpool then? Are you giving them a chance against Liverpool?
No.
The 42.ie's Gavin Cooney is in studio to chat about the FAI commissioned report into the funding of horse and greyhound racing and the response of the government to the concerns raised. Gavin, how are you?
How are you? This is just as glamorous as that sounds now.
This is a really glamorous Monday morning chat, and I do thank you for giving up some of your time to talk about this today, Gavin. It's a sober sounding subject, but well, first of all, before we get into it, why is it significant? Why did you decide to pick up on it in your detailed piece over
the
last few days?
The FAI need money. I mean, the FAI have this strategy document that was published last year. I was on the show talking about it and wrote about it extensively. They've got other documents coming down the line, investment strategies and player pathway strategies. So, like, the future of the sport in Ireland desperately needs investment, and this, the FAI believe, is one avenue to getting that. And then you've had the government response of the last week, which has been quite disingenuous, and actually the FAI's report raised some questions, the government's response to it raised even more.
Okay, so let's start with the first part of that. What questions did the FAI commissioned report raise in the first place?
Yeah, so it was titled a report on the horse and greyhound fund and the context for sports funding in Ireland. So it's 77 pages long, it's fairly detailed. It took me quite a while to get my head around it, but it's based off the betting tax. So the horse and greyhound fund is the pot of money that funds those two sports slash activities slash industries, and has done since 2001. So the law states that it's linked to the betting tax. So every bet that's placed in Ireland, there's a 2% tax on it. Now, that doesn't matter if it's on sport, what sport it's on, if it's on Eurovision, if it's on Owen's prospects of being the next Late Late Show, everything goes to the horse and greyhound fund. So the FAI said this is quite an unusual mechanism. The FAI's report, should I say, said this is quite an unusual mechanism, because regardless of what you're betting on, everything is going to subsidising these two sports. And then the law also states that 80% of that money goes to the horse racing industry, and another 20% goes to the greyhound industry. So, I mean, the state has paid nearly 1.6 billion euro into this fund since the year 2001, and the FAI argue, well, look, not all sports bets are on horse racing. We estimate that around 30% of bets are on football, so why can't we get our fair share?
Which is what are their proposed solutions to this?
So this report puts in three of them. Yeah, so it's keep the tax at 2%, but allocated more fairly based off other sports. So they say 60% for horse and greyhound racing, 20% for football, and 20% for other sports. That's based on a proportion of bets placed on sports. Another is to raise it to 3% and allocate along those lines, and an additional one is to raise it to 3% but guarantee that the 2021 total will be ring fenced for the horse and greyhound fund going forward. So that was just the money that they got in 2021 will be guaranteed.
So why did you say that you feel that the response from the government has raised more concerns even than the initial questions did?
Yeah, because they effectively they said that the FAI's entire argument is moot. So this was first reported by the Irish Independent last Wednesday week. RT Drive Time did a piece on it the following day, and they got a statement from the Department of Sport. Now, the horse and greyhound industries are not under the Department of Sport. It is the Department of Agriculture. But the Department of Sport came out and said that we subsequently engaged with the Department of Finance, who advised that the money raised in the betting tax just goes into the general state coffers rather than is specifically ring-fenced for the horse and greyhound fund. So they actually say that as such, the question of how the betting duty proceeds are allocated is moot. So on the face of that, the FAI looked like complete clowns, because they've commissioned this big report. This is a central piece of work for them, and the entire premise of it based off that is wrong, which is, you know, very embarrassing for the FAI. And then they got kicked around the place, but in certainly racing media outlets, saying that I think there was one on the At the Races website which called it bizarre and ill-founded. But that's not fair to the FAI at all, because that claim that they're not linked is not credible based off practice that we've seen from everyone involved. Like, the FAI's, this own report does say, like, something happened in 2009, but we're not really quite sure what. that severed the link between the betting tax and the funding to horse and greyhound industries. Now, the law still states that they're linked. Last week we asked the Department of Finance and the Department of Agriculture to point us to the law in which things changed. We're a week on and we haven't heard back. So, you know, I maintain open to correction on that if they come back to me. But no, I found no amendment to that law.
But sorry, why is it so important to establish whether or not these are still linked? If you could just clarify that for us, and why are you saying that in practice they are linked, even if we're being told they're not?
Well, why it's important to establish whether they are linked or not is, like, on what basis then has the state been funding the horse and greyhound industry since 2001? So every year, politicians and the Minister of Agriculture returns the dole to approve that year's annual funding for the horse and greyhound industries. And every year, the law cited is the 2001 Horse and Greyhound Act, which established this fund. That is the basis for the 80-20 split that I referred to. If the betting fund and the horse and greyhound, the betting tax and the horse and greyhound fund are not linked, then on what basis have we been doling out nearly €1.6 billion to these two industries over the last, however, since 2001? Have we had a selective application of that law? So I think that's important. And then, sorry, your second question.
The second part of it was, you said that in practice it is, you feel they are still linked.
Well, we're told
they're not.
Yeah, we're told that since 2009, this is apparently when they were severed. If they have been severed, it's been kept a kind of
secret,
exquisite secret. Like, I mean, like, why? For instance, the horse racing industry have continued to lobby for an increase in the betting tax. They finally got their way when it went from 1%
to 2%. But it's got nothing to do with them.
Yeah, but if it had nothing to do with them,
then you'd expect them to want there to be no betting tax.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, well, the betting tax is paid by the bookmaker rather than the punter, but that is a side issue. Like, why would the HRI spend so much time lobbying for an increase in the betting tax if it wasn't linked to them? I mean, we're told that these things split in 2009. Simon Coveney was the Minister for Agriculture in 2011. He was talking about the link between them. The Minister for Finance, Michael Noonan, the same year, said that the lowering of the rate to 1% had seen betting duty receipts fall from all-time high, and that this had been tied to the funding for horse racing and greyhound racing through the Greyhound Fund. So, if you know, as we're told that there's been no link between these since 2009, would have been great if everyone involved would know it. You know, it's actually like, you know, if a class of 30 Leaving Cert students fail the French exam at the end of the year and clearly show that they haven't learned what they were supposed to learn, you ask questions of the teacher there. You don't ask questions of the 30 students. So it's quite, I find the response pretty disingenuous. I mean, like, even the HRI chairman wrote in his annual report in 2010, "We welcome the government's commitment to betting duty as the basis of the Horse and Greyhound Racing Fund." 2012 annual report by a new chairman, Joe Keeling, "Horse Racing Ireland welcomes an Indicon report and congratulations Minister Coveney, his department and Indicon on the work done. It addresses the case for a betting levy regime to bring all betting providers into the tax system and provide an adequate and consistent level of funding for the horse racing industry." And lastly, there was in 2017, there was a report by Deloitte which assessed the economic impact of horse racing. So this is the document that is the Bible for anyone justifying the state investment into the horse racing industry, is that A, it's an industry and it's providing 29,500 jobs, and it returns €30 to the state for every €1 invested. So that is...
Sounds like the best investment ever.
It does.
We should probably put more money into it based on that.
But that report, Ken, also says that the Irish government supports the Irish breeding and racing industry through the Horse and Greyhound Fund. A 1% betting tax on all bets placed by Irish punters feeds into the fund, which in 2016 paid €60 million to HRI and is included in core industry expenditure. So the idea that these things are not linked, there may have been some severing of an explicit link, but there's clearly linked in practicality. And there is a correlation between the monies paid in, the returns from the betting tax from 2019 to 2021 were €5 million more than the figure, 80% of the funds from the betting tax was only €5 million more than what was paid to the horse racing industry in that time. And then we finally had a bit of clarity last week from a civil servant called Brendan Gleeson from the Department of Agriculture, who says that, yeah, there is a betting tax there. It's in the mid 90 millions. That's correct. It covers or close to matches the cost of this, being the horse racing fund. It's not a strict process of ring fencing, but it's part of the policy picture that supports the investment of these sectors. So they're not linked, But this money just happens to pay for it.
Tell me, you mentioned the horse racing Bible, which they said horse racing is the backbone of the Irish economy or whatever. Is there a greyhound racing Bible? If not, is there any? What's the basis of the greyhound industry's claim to receive a quarter of the funding that horse racing? I mean, horse racing, I can see is big. Maybe it's just because horses are big. You know, horses are bigger than greyhounds. The whole thing just seems on a grander scale.
Yeah,
greyhound racing, really? I mean, what's the basis for such massive funding in an industry which, I mean, the last I heard, they were killing about 6,000 dogs a year.
It's difficult to ascertain, quite honestly. I mean, like 16.8 million euro of our money went to the greyhound industry in 2019. It seems to me that these things have just always been linked.
And it must always proceed in lockstep. This is at a 4-to-1 ratio. Yeah. So if horse racing gets, you know, gets 10, then the greyhound racing has to get 250.
Yeah. For instance, like when the horse racing industry got COVID relief money in 2020, the greyhound industry got a bump there because that's what's in the law. And you can, okay, that's in the low and we can change it, but also to go back to Owen's earlier question as to why it's important just to figure out whether there's a link between the betting tax and not, was just like, well, that's in that low as well. So yeah. You know, it seems, and look, again, we've asked the departments for answers and we're open to being correct. The Department Still of not. Sport did say this is a question for the Department of Agriculture.
You've got to ask someone else.
So it is very whatever. I think obviously there are clear benefits to the horse race, to investment in the horse racing industry. The FAI's report questions the scale of it, but the same argument is almost impossible to make for greyhound racing. I mean, 2019 total attendances in 2019 and going to the dogs, in a kind of a metaphorical and literal sense, 463,000 people. So it's down from a third of its peak. So, you know, we've been ploughing money into this and it's only dwindling.
Are there figures, reliable figures, for the proportion of bets that go in each of these sports?
It's difficult, not in Ireland, because there's no data on it. So the FAI report relies on data from the gambling commissioner in the UK. So they estimate around 60% into horse racing and greyhound racing, and then, you know, roughly 30% into football. But it's that data doesn't exist in Ireland because the revenue doesn't collect it, because all of the money is going to these two sports from betting data, so from the betting tax. So, you know, why count those figures?
The technical nature of the objection to what the FAI are saying, that is, well, I mean, this is all moot because this isn't really like that. There isn't really a link. Seems to me to dodge the more important issue of the fairness of the allocation of funding. You know, you're just kind of saying, oh, well, this isn't, you're stupid for coming up and saying this, because this isn't it. But the FAI have a strong case here. And if there is no link between betting tax and money spent on sport, then maybe we should bring one in. Because it seems to me, you know, if you're going to have gambling, and a lot of people think we shouldn't even have it, but if you are going to have this, you know, corrosive social evil, then at least you can, you know, get it to pay for some of the things that it's gambling about. And if so, then football is obviously, you know, one of the main things people do gamble on. Yeah. So
that, you're completely right. And so the FAI's report, this report was done and submitted to the government back in September 2021. So it has taken a while for it to come to light. And also, obviously, Dan McDonald had to publish it before I became aware of it and then subsequently read it. But I don't know why we've wasted a week of public debate on this, arguing about the semantics of, is this money technically, like, literally ring fence from the betting tax to go into the horse and greyhound fund, or is there no link, but there's, you know, it's part of the policy picture? Like, that seems like a complete waste of a week's debate around this. And that's, I find that interesting. I always find it interesting when fair arguments are immediately dismissed as moot by the people who might be affected by them. Again, that's not credible.
Moot, I mean, a word no one even really knows what it means. what does it even mean? It means you could have a debate about that, but it's irrelevant somehow. Mm. What does moot even mean?
Just on this, though.
I'm looking at that point moot
temporarily, Ken. While I ask about the FAI, they have had a government bailout relatively recently. They have had government funding. So is there a question there as to, are they not already getting what they need from the government?
Mm. I've seen that point made. I don't think it's fair, really. They obviously got a government bailout for having been run into the ground during the John Delaney tenure. The terms of that, I think, are... I know other sports were quite put out by the fact that the FAI's punishment for being run to the ground was having their state funding doubled for 3 years to bail them out. But I think this is it's the FAI's job to try and find money for football in Ireland. All other sports are good at advocating for themselves and lobbying for themselves.
Are there better ways than this, though, Gavin? I don't know.
Like, I don't think there is. Well, I think this is a good way of approaching it.
Just in a climate when sports bodies around the world are being asked or should be being asked to examine their relationship with gambling.
Mm.
The FAI, is there not something jarring about the FAI's best idea to raise funds being to try to get a bigger slice of the gambling pie?
That is a fair argument. I mean, the FAI will say that, you know, they've foregone a gambling sponsor on the front of the national team jersey. Like, I mean, you know, this is a major stick with which they've been beaten over the last couple of years, that they haven't got a sponsor. They could have got a gambling sponsor and the board voted against it. So, you know, they haven't promoted gambling in that respect. Your broader point is fair, but what I would, the counter argument to it is that the FAI need money, and rather than going with a begging bowl to the government, they're like, well, hang on, this revenue stream exists, and is this the fairest way?
That is still gambling revenue, though. I don't see how they can make, you want to call it a moral stand about not taking gambling advertising on their shirt, but yet they are at the same time advocating for a slice of this gambling money. In another, through the government,
there is a difference there. I mean, you know, they're not themselves promoting gambling, but gambling is something which is allowed here under the current law. So, you know, it's subject to tax like any other like regulated activity. So, why shouldn't the sport on which a lot of these bets are placed benefit from that? You know, they're not going out there with like a bookmaker's name on the front of their shirts, which kids are going to be wearing or whatever. You know, I mean,
it does feel like they're only going so far with that stance then, though, if they are...
Well, if we're going to take that stance, we should get rid of these greyhound, these cruel sports which only exist for gambling anyway. You know what I mean? I'd see greyhound racing banned long before I'd see gambling banned.
Hmm.
That's a personal view.
What's your moot? What's your definition of moot?
Moot basically means we could argue about it, but there's no point. We wouldn't be able to come to a decision about it anyway. You know, which seems like a kind of a, okay, subject to debate, dispute, or uncertainty, or having little or no practical relevance, typically because the subject is too uncertain to allow decision. And I'm not sure if that really applies to this discussion, actually. Another kind of, another sign, besides the kind of lawyerly objection, you know, oh, this is moot, is that there's a bit of tone policing as well. I was a bit surprised to see... Well, I suppose Ian Mallon, who used to be the, the communications chief for the FAI, does call him in the Examiner now. And I guess he's only reporting this when he says government insiders believe the report was, as the FAI report was, in the words of one senior Marion Street source, arrogant, entitled, politically naive and badly advised. There are other elements of the attempt to force a change in government policy which surprised advisors and government insiders, particularly the time of the demand amid a housing and refugee accommodation crisis. There are also issues with the tone of the FAI paper, which contained little by way of expression of gratitude. So this is all tone stuff. I also saw Philip Quinn in the Daily Mail comparing the FAI to Oliver Twist, begging for more. But Oliver Twist was entitled to go up and chance his arm. You know what I mean? Surely Oliver Twist, like, he was hungry.
But it's natural that the FAI are asking for money. It's very hard to ask people for money and not give them a headache. I mean, it is their job. It's not the FAI or any other sports body's job to sit there and agree to feel grateful for what they're giving. Like, on a broader point, sports funding in Ireland is quite poor. I mean, this own FAI report says 0.4% of Ireland's GDP goes to sports funding. The EU average is 0.8%. Like, we're way at the bottom of the table. So, like, the idea that the FAI should be made to feel grateful for what they have, I don't think is a fair one. And I think that stymies the potential development of the sport here.
Because there is a real case here. I mean, this is a much bigger sport than either horse or ground racing by participation in terms of the number of people's lives that it affects and can improve.
But what you say there kind of leads on to...
And also in terms of the number of dead animals it generates.
What you say there leads on to kind of an important element of the debate as to whether the greyhound and horse racing activities, let's begin by calling them that, are sports or industries.
And they call themselves industries.
Mm. I found a government report into this in 2009, which I found the best definition of it. So they define sports as being for the primary beneficiaries of that are its participants, whereas an industry, the primary benefits of it is the economy at large. Now, the horse racing industry will say that the economy has massively benefited and continues to benefit from the state investment in it. As we mentioned, €30 yield for every €1 invested.
28,900 jobs.
Yeah. Now, the FAI's report does question that, you know, like they does argue should. Like
I mean, you know, it questions it on the fact, it questions the fact,
yeah, like it points out like of that 28,900, 6,000 are employed in betting shops,
where they're taking bets from people betting on football,
and 7,700 people are employed in secondary industry. So do they owe their livelihood solely to horse racing? The FAI's report says that that's not valid, so there's question marks around that as well. And on the industry sense then, I mean the HRI do say that like horse racing is quite dependent on the state funding. I mean, but they're spending the bulk of it on prize money. 64.5% of the 2019 allocation to the HRI went on prize
money.
That
sounds like a benefit that goes primarily to the participants.
And the FAI's report would argue just very few participants. The top 10 owners in both types of racing won almost one third of all the prize money in 2019.
That's great. So Michael O'Leary and people like this are getting money, which is from the exchequer. It's not even from betting tax, apparently.
Mm.
But the other point about that, and I think this is, I mean, this annoys me, right? The thing that you said about essentially that industry is privileged above sport, based on this claim that it benefits the economy as opposed to who? The participants. Who are the participants? The participants are the people of this country.
Mm.
And they're actually existing people. Why do we have a system that's saying, well, one thing benefits the economy, the other thing only benefits the people. So, you know, that's not as important.
And the idea that these are industries rather than sports is massively open to debate.
Oh,
like, I mean, you buy the Racing Post to get the results. You don't buy the Financial Times. Like, and the FAI's own report then does make the point, and, you know, it is an interesting one. If this is such a successful industry, why is it so...
Why does it need to be propped up with state subsidies to this extent?
That's exactly it. Like, I referenced this... Sorry, I realise listeners will have their heads in a tizzy with all these reports, etc. There was one in 2012 by a group called Indicon, which recommended that the horse racing and the greyhound industries wean themselves off state funding. That hasn't happened. You know, they're still quite reliant on it. And, you know, the FAI's report does raise questions as to too much of it is going to going on prize money.
Gavin Cooney, well explained as always. Thanks a million.
Oh, I hope so. Thanks a million.
Owen, I like you and I like your style.
The second captain. We've got a bit better quality.
It's confident any place, anywhere, all over the world.
Full of protein.
It's information, fluid information.
I don't know what you're talking about.
You can do it while you're cleaning the house, brushing your teeth, taking a bath.
Trying to be critical is going to be impossible.
Before we even get to the Champions League tomorrow night, there are some Premier League fixtures on. Well, in fact, one of them is on probably right now, as some of you are listening to this. Fulham against Leicester, 3 p.m. Bank holiday. It's bank holiday, of course.
Oh, yeah. That's 3 o'clock.
Yeah, 3 o'clock. It's not on TV.
It's a bank holiday, of course, because the king and all. We didn't even mention the king.
The king and all.
We were... There was a bit of booing at some grounds. Lusty renditions of God Save the King at West Ham and Rangers.
Very lusty at West Ham.
Oh, they loved it. They absolutely, they loved the king there. But obviously there were regrettable scenes elsewhere at Celtic. Mm, and
shocking.
Liverpool.
Brighton Everton is on at 5:30 on BT Sport kickoff. And then Nottingham Forest, Southampton is 8 o'clock on Sky Sports. And of course, Real Madrid against Manchester City tomorrow night. We'll be talking about all that during the week. We've got the great Trent debate. Mm. Ken and Damien on Thursday. And that's all for World Service members. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thank you, Owen. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Kieran. Thank you, Owen.
Second Cabin's podcast, need I remind you, is part of the
Acast creator network.
Ich bin stolz, er ist überall bekannt. Imo kommt aus Leipzig, ist ein Torgarant. Imo Erner spielt für unser Land. Imo Erner ist kein Uhrensohn. 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 Icke Hüftgold ist ein Uhrensohn.
How long is that? That's the second time it's gone off. They never go home. Those boys.
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.